Chapter 9. Apples Benedict, a Hedgehog, and Commander Bradshaw. Imagine a transference recording device. A machine used to write books in the well. The ITRD resembles a large horn, typically 8 feet across and made of brass. Attached to a polished mahogany mixing board, a little like a church organ, but with many more stops and levers. As the story is enacted in front of the collecting horn, the actions, dialogue, humour, pathos, etc. are collected, mixed, and transmitted as raw data to Text Grand Central, where the wordsmiths hammer it into readable story code. Once done, it is beamed direct to the author's pen or typewriter, and from there through a live footnotophone link back to the well as plain text. The page is read, and if all is well, it is added to the manuscript and the characters move on. The beauty of the system is that all through this other suspect a thing. They think they do all the work. Commander Trafford Bradshaw, CBE. Bradshaw's Guide to the Bookworld. "I'm hurt," I yelled as I walked through the door. Pickwick plucked happily up to me, realized I didn't have any marshmallows, and then left in a huff, only to return with the gift of a piece of paper she had found in the waste paper basket. I thanked her profusely, and she went back to her egg. "Hello," said Ib, who had been experimenting, beaten-like, in the kitchen. "What's in the bag?"
"You don't want to know."
"Hmm," replied Ib thoughtfully. "Since I wouldn't have asked if I didn't want to know, your response must have been another way of saying, 'I'm not going to tell you, so sod off.' Is that correct?" "More or less," I replied, placing the bag in the broom cupboard. "Is Gran around?"
"I don't think so."
Ob walked in a little later, reading a textbook entitled Personalities for Beginners. "Hello, Thursday," it said. "A hedgehog and a tortoise came round to see you this afternoon."
"What did they want?"
"They didn't say."
"And Gran?"
"In the Outland. She said not to wait up for her. You look very tired. Are you okay?"
It was true. I was tired. But I wasn't sure why. Stress?
It's not every day that you have to fight swarms of grammarcites and deal with Havisham's driving, Yahoo's, Thrall's, Big Martin's friends, or head-in-a-bag plot devices. Maybe it was just the baby playing silly buggers with my hormones.
"What's for supper?" I asked, slumping in a chair and closing my eyes.
"I've been experimenting with alternative recipes," said Ib. "So we're having Apples Benedict."
"Apples Benedict?"
"Yes. It's like Eggs Benedict, but with..."
"I get the picture. Anything else?"
"Of course. You could try turnips à l'orange or macaroni custard. For pudding, I've made anchovy trifle and herring fool. What will you have?"
"Beans on toast," I sighed. It was like being back home at Mother's. I didn't dream that night. Landon was absent, and then so, too, was... what's her name? I slept soundly and missed the alarm. I woke up feeling terrible and just lay flat on my back, breathing deeply and trying to push away the clouds of nausea. There was a rap at the door.
"Ib!" I yelled. "Can you get that?"
My head throbbed, but there was no answer. I glanced at the clock. It was nearly 9, and both of them would be out at St. Tablerasa's, practising whimsical asides or something. I hauled myself out of bed, steadied myself for a moment, wrapped myself in a dressing gown and went downstairs. No one was there when I opened the door. I was just closing it when a small voice said,
"We're down here!"
It was a hedgehog and a tortoise. But the hedgehog wasn't like Mrs. Tiggywinkle, who was as tall as me. This hedgehog and tortoise were just the size they should have been.
"Thursday next?" said the hedgehog.
"Yes.
What can I do for you?"
"You can stop poking your nose in where it's not wanted," said the hedgehog haughtily. "That's what you can do."
"I don't understand."
"Painted jaguar?"
suggested the tortoise.
"Can't curl, can't swim. Ring any bells, smart Alec?"
"Oh, you must be stickly, prickly and slow solid."
"The same. And that little mnemonic you so kindly gave to the painted jaguar is going to cause us a few problems. The dopey feline will never forget that in a month of Sundays."
I sighed. Living in the book world was a great deal more complicated than I had imagined.
"Well, why don't you learn to swim or something?"
"Who, me?"
said Stickly Prickly.
Don't be absurd. Whoever heard of a hedgehog swimming?
And you could learn to curl, I added to Slow Solid.
Curl?
Replied the tortoise indignantly.
I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Give it a go, I persisted. Unlace your back plates a little and try and touch your toes. There was a pause. The hedgehog and the tortoise looked at one another and giggled.
Won't Painted Jaguar be surprised?
They chortled, thanked me, and left. I closed the door, sat down and looked in the fridge, shrugged and ate a large portion of Apples Benedict before having a long and relaxing shower. The corridors of the well were as busy as the day before. Traders bustled with buyers, deals were done, orders taken, bargains struck. Every now and then I saw characters fading in and out as their trade took them from book to book. I looked at the shop fronts as I walked past, trying to guess how they did what they did. There were wholesmiths, grammaticists, pace-setters, mood-mongers, paginators, you name it.
Special on at St. Tablerasa's Generic College. Superior quality blocking characters available now for instant location to your novel. From forbidding fathers to buy-the-book superior police officers, our high-quality blockers will guarantee conflict from the simplest protagonist. Call free footnotophone / St. Tablerasa's for more details.
It was the junk footnotophone starting up again. I tried to shut it out, but only succeeded in lowering the volume. As I walked along, I noticed a familiar figure amongst the traders and plot speculators. He was dressed in his usual African explorer garb. Safari jacket, pith helmet, shorts, stout boots, and a revolver in a leather holster. It was Commander Bradshaw, star of 34 thrilling adventure stories for boys available in hardback at 7 and 6 each. Out of print since the 30s, Bradshaw entertained himself in his retirement by being something of an eminence grise at jurisfiction. He had seen and done it all, or claimed he had.
100!
He exclaimed bitterly as I drew closer.
Is that the best you can offer?
The action sequence trader he was talking to shrugged.
We don't get much call for lion attacks these days. But it's terrifying, man, terrifying! Exclaimed Bradshaw. Real hot breath down the back of your neck stuff. Brighten up contemporary romantic fiction, no end, I should wager. Make a change from parties and frocks, what?
120, then. Take it or leave it.
Bloodsucker,
mumbled Bradshaw, taking the money and handing over a small glass globe with the lion attack, I presumed, safely freeze-dried within. He turned away from the trader and caught me looking at him. He quickly hid the cash and raised his pith helmet politely.
Good morning.
Good morning, I replied. He waved a finger at me.
It's Havisham's apprentice. Is your name again?
Thursday next.
Is it, by gum? Well, I never.
He was, I noticed, a good foot taller than the last time we had met. He now almost came up to my shoulder.
You're much...
I began, then checked myself.
Taller?
He guessed.
Quite correct, girlie. Appreciate a woman who isn't trammelled by the conventions of good manners. Melanie, that's the wife, you know. She's pretty rude, too. Trafford, she says. That's my name, Trafford. Trafford, she said. You're a worthless heap of elephant dung. Well, this was from out of the blue. I had just returned home after a harrowing adventure in Central Africa, where I was captured and nearly roasted on a spit. The sacred emerald of the Umpopo had been stolen by 2 Swedish prospectors, and,
Commander Bradshaw, I interrupted, desperate to stop him from recounting one of his highly unlikely and overtly jingoistic adventures. Have you seen Miss Havisham this morning?
Quite right to interrupt me, he said cheerfully. Appreciate a woman who knows when to subtly tell a boring old fart to button his lip. You and Mrs. Bradshaw have a lot in common. You must meet up some day.
We walked down the busy corridor.
Vera, is that you? What a day, all noise and rain. Do please carry on about Anna. Well, Anna danced with Vronsky at the ball that night. He became her shadow and very much more. No, Alexei Vronsky and Anna, an affair. What about her husband? Surely he found out. Eventually, yes. I think Anna told him. But not until she was with child. Vronsky's child. There was to be no hiding that.
What did he say?
Believe it or not, he forgave them both. insisted that they remain married and attempted to continue as if nothing had happened. I always did think that man was a fool. What happened next? Vronsky shot himself, claiming he could not bear to be apart. Melodramatic is not the word for it. It reads like a cheap novelette. Did he die? No, merely wounded. It gets worse. Karenin realized that to save Anna, he himself must take the disgrace and admit that he had been unfaithful, so that Anna was not ruined and could marry Vronsky. So Karenin let him go? He didn't ban her from ever seeing her lover again? Didn't horsewhip either of them or sell his story to the mole?
It strikes me Karenin himself may have had some totty on the side, too.
Wait! My husband calls me. Stay tuned. Farewell for now, my dear Vera.
I tapped my ears.
Problems?
Inquired Bradshaw.
Yes, I've got two gossiping Russians inside my head again.
Cross line, infernal contraptions. Have a word with Plum at Juristek if it persists, I say.
He went on, lowering his voice and looking round furtively.
You won't tell anyone about that lion attack sale, will you? If somebody gets around that old Bradshaw is cashing in on his action sequences, I'll never hear the last of it.
I won't say a word, I assured him as we avoided a trader trying to sell us surplus B3 Darcy clones. But do many people try and sell off parts of their own book?
Oh, yes, but only if they're out of print and can spare it. Trouble is, I'm a bit strapped for the old moolah. What with the Book World Awards coming up and Mrs. Bradshaw a bit shy in public, I thought a new dress might be just the ticket. And the cost of clothes are pretty steep down here, you know.
It's the same in the Outland.
Is it, by George? He guffawed. The well always reminds me of the market in Nairobi. How about you?
There seems to be an awful lot of bureaucracy. I would have thought a fiction factory would be, by definition, a lot more free and relaxed.
If you think this is bad, you ought to visit non-fiction. Over there, the rules governing the correct use of a semicolon alone run to several volumes. Anything devised by man has bureaucracy. Corruption and error, hardwired at inception, McGurl. I'm surprised you hadn't figured that out yet. What do you think of the well?
I'm still a bit new to it.
Really? Let me help you out.
He stopped and looked around for a moment, then pointed out a man in his early 20s who was walking towards us. He was dressed in a long riding jacket and carried a battered leather suitcase, emblazoned with the names of books and plays he had visited in his trade. Yes?
He's an artisan, a holesmith.
He's a plasterer?
No, he fills narrative holes, plot and expositional anomalies, loopholes. If a writer said something like, "The daffodils bloomed in summer," or "They checked the ballistics report on the shotgun," then artisans like him are out there to sort it out. It's one of the final stages of construction, just before the grammaticists, echolocators and spell checkers move in to smooth everything over.
The young man had drawn level with us by this time.
"Hello, Mr. Starboard," said Bradshaw to the holesmith,
who gave a wan smile of recognition.
"Commander Bradshaw," he muttered, slightly hesitantly.
"What a truly delightful honour it is to meet you again, sir. Mrs. Bradshaw, quite well?"
"Quite well, thank you. This is Miss Next, new at the department. I'm showing her the ropes."
The holesmith shook my hand and made welcoming noises. "I closed a hole in Great Expectations the other day," I told him. "Was that one of your books?"
"Goodness me, no,"
exclaimed the young man, smiling for the first time.
"Hole stitching has come a long way since Dickens.
You won't find a holesmith worth his thread, trying the old door opens and in comes the missing aunt slash father slash business associate slash friend, etc., all ready to explain where they've been since mysteriously dropping out of the narrative 200 pages previously. The methodology we choose these days is to just go back and patch the hole, or more simply, to camouflage it."
"I see."
"Indeed," carried on the young man, becoming more flamboyant in the light of my perceived interest. "I'm working on a system that hides holes by highlighting them to the reader, that just says, 'Ho, I'm a hole, don't think about it.' But it's a little cutting edge.
I think,"
added the young man airily, "that you will not find a more experienced holesmith anywhere in the well.
I've been doing it for more than 40 years.
When did you start? I asked, looking at the youth curiously.
As a baby?
The young man aged, grayed, and sagged before my eyes until he was in his 70s, and then announced, arms outstretched and with a flourish,
"Ta-da! No one likes a show-off, Lister," said Bradshaw, looking at his watch. "I don't want to hurry you Tuesday, old girl, but we should be getting over to Norland Park for the roll call."
He gallantly offered me an elbow to hold, and I hooked my arm in his. "Thank you, Commander."
"Stouter than stout," Bradshaw
said, laughing, and read us both into Sense and Sensibility.